It's a pleasure to have you here tonight, Tom Wolfe, and I'm wondering if your purpose, like the purpose of Mark Twain, is to entertain.
Excuse me. Well, I think every writer should build a platform that's called entertainment, because entertainment's a very simple concept. Entertainment is anything that you can enjoy passing the time away with without physical effort. And it's pretty much true. And the idea that you're going to have avant-garde work by not entertaining is a deeply believed in concept right now. But entertainment's, you have to start with that. You have to start with that.
Tell us a little bit about this trip we just had upstairs. I'd like you to share the feeling you had seeing some of those manuscripts. We showed you things that matter to you, some of your idols, Charles Dickens, even Nabokov. There were some extraordinary manuscripts you saw.
Well, you've already expressed in very, very vivid terms what the love of literature is. As I
remind me, I can't remember what I said.
I don't think you left anything out, other than embracing the book. But actually, I did. I've always been interested in people's handwriting, people from the past, and that's because, above all, for years, I wrote everything on a typewriter, and then came the computer. I struggled with that for about 2.5 years. I think I was born at the wrong time, because this last book that I've done has been completely handwritten. And
what do you write with?
I write with a twist erase mechanical pencil. Good erasers. You can just, you know, it's almost as good as a computer. You should try them. Twist Erase is the brand name.
The name of the pencil is called Twist
Erase. It's an automatic pencil. And I have people here who can vouch for that. That's what I use.
You were very fascinated when we were upstairs in the Berg collection. Isaac Gerwitz showed us some of the treasures we have here. You were very fascinated by the size of the handwriting. What is it in particular that interests you so much in size?
Well, you probably can save time, but I think they were saving, in the case of someone like Dickens, a very tiny handwriting. He really did two things with it. One, he saved paper, which I gather was costly at the time. But he also made himself feel it was possible to get a day's work done. I just want to have to go back and see some of these.
Yes.
He wrote on a slip, he called it. It was about this wide and about this high. And with his tiny handwriting, he could squeeze in 600 words on each side. And that was 1,200 words. And that was a day's work. At that point, he could do the rest of the day, which he loved. He loved exercise. He used to walk 3 miles a day. I mean, yes, 3 miles at 4 miles an hour. That's fast. That's a fast walk. Sometimes he would ride horseback for the same reason. As long as you use your legs a lot in horseback riding. But it was, to me, mainly the tiny handwriting to get those slips done. He called them slips. Another thing, he very seldom made a correction. I cannot say that.
Twist eraser that explains it. Isaac Gerwitz also showed you some pages of your own manuscripts.
That's right. They were. They keep them on permanent display, but there were some.
But because I wrote down the first lines of, I believe it is, it a story? Is it an essay? I don't know what it is. It's called Good Buildings.
Yes, this was about the 48 good buildings in New York.
And the first lines, the tinsel quality of social life, Louis Auchinschloss once said, debases a writer who tries to describe it, comes off, so to speak, in his hands. Writer's reign, Louis, writer's reign. Perhaps that is why no historian, no sociologist, no cartographer, no one at all, not even some desperate journalist, already your love of journalists there, no, not a desperate journalist, has ever published a map of the triangle in New York or of the 42 good buildings. Tell us a little bit about this story. I don't know, I have never read it.
Well, this was a very highly intellectual article I wrote. I believe it was for Esquire. It was about the 42 most fashionable apartment houses to live in New York at that time. I don't know what year it was, but it probably hasn't changed very much. And the triangle you speak of is a triangle that goes from Sutton Place to Fifth Avenue down to 96th Street. And then what's interesting is if you draw the hypotenuse, the other line, it has practically all of the fashionable buildings in it. You get to 96th Street, you see, you just have a little end of this triangle that's fashionable, and the rest of it you really shouldn't have anything to do with.
Did you know we had this manuscript?
No, I had no idea.
You must have donated it at some point to the library.
I may have left it on the desk downstairs. I don't know. It's not a landmark in my career, I don't think. But at the end of the piece, the piece ends in Le Cirque, when it used to be on 50...
The restaurant.
50-something, 52nd Street, and very fashionable. And walked in the door, and there was Richard Nixon having a conversation with Henry Kissinger on one of the prize seats, which was the banquette. But everyone was staring at someone else. So I looked over, and the person they were all staring at was Alice Mason. She was the prime real estate broker. And Nixon, Kissinger later, but we're interested in getting the best apartment we can. That still goes on, except now the city is divided into downtown, which is where everybody under the age of 37 wants to live. And they refer to where I live, the East 70s, as upstate. So I refer to where they live as North Jersey. But you have to fight back. I mean,
for the past few years, about 5 years now, I've asked writers and people we invite here at the library for live events to provide me with a biography in 7 words. And they all very kindly submit to this exercise. It's kind of a haiku of sorts, if you're very modern. I don't know if you... Do you tweet?
I don't... Tweet. I don't tweet.
Well, it is kind of a tweet of sorts. And the 7 words you gave me...
Total realism. Go ahead.
And I don't understand all of them, and I will ask you for some explanation, is Ace Daddy, Jim Rat, Balzolan Reporter, and then the last one, P HD. Now, does the order matter?
Oh, of course.
And what does each term mean?
Well, you know, if you pull a haiku apart, you kind of destroy the function of it.
Well, so much for my question. Let me destroy it further. And
I do advise going to the gym every day. It's the only chance you have of staying upright for any prolonged length of time. It's on my mind now. I don't know why.
So that takes care of gym rat. Ace Daddy?
That's the title I would like most to have. And there's some people here who know what I mean.
Balzolan reporter. I do have a sense of that. And in a sense, even the way you were describing upstate and downtown, there is something already at work there in the notion of Balzolan reporter. I had to think a moment when I got those words and figured out that perhaps you were conflating or putting together two of your literary heroes, Balzac and Zola, and reporting.
You're quite good, because I actually...
Thank God. Yeah, yeah.
I actually took that great phrase, Balzolan, from a French friend of mine, who kept telling me that you want to be Balzac or Zola, don't you? Then he started calling me Balzola, and then I discovered that is my ideal. That is my ideal. For one thing, unlike myself, they wrote so fast. Balzac wrote so fast, pumped up in 20 years from 1930, his 31st year to his 51st, 90 books. They could not serialize them. There were just too many of them. His manuscripts looked like trees. He started when it was in type. And then he would start making lines out to what he wanted it to actually be. And he also loved nightlife. So he would start writing at 11:30 p.m. up until about 8, all the while drinking, 8 in the morning. And he would sleep until about 4, just in time to go to the next party. And to keep this regimen up, he drank coffee.
All the time.
All the time. And he finally got to Turkish coffee, which I think is great stuff. You can stand a spoon up in it. You go at Turkish coffee. And I don't know if it actually was the cause, but he dropped dead at 51. But, I mean, talk about turnout. Talk about turnout. Zola, I think, at this time is much underestimated, because he was such a thoroughgoing and dedicated realist. He had moved from one industry to another. A whole book for the honor of women about department stores, which was a new thing in his time.
Le bonheur des dames.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
he was very interested in also how in department stores one started to figure out that objects needed to be moved so that people, when they came in from one day to the next, would find a new display, kind of the sex appeal of the inanimate.
Well, I don't remember that, but that's the kind of thing that would really interest him. He had been reading Darwin, which has undone more than one person. And he wrote a novel called The Human Beast, and it's about four murderers who murdering four different people, and none of them really has a connection with the other. I mean, it's just one death after another. It's a great, but it's a great book. And I think he would have never hit upon the theme, except that Darwin said that there's no cardinal distinction between the animal and man. And there are people who believe that to this day. It's bleak but exciting for a writer, I think. Exciting for a writer.
Have you visited some of Balzac's homes?
Yes, I have. And what stands out is the fact that he never had a permanent home.
He always was fleeing because copy editors were trying to find him. He was indebted all the time. I remember one of his desks, which was, you actually could see his arm in it. He had scribbled so much. Incredible. I mean, he always had a back door from which to flee.
Well, you know, the house of Balzac in Paris was just such a place, a small house, and I was told that he had to pay a certain amount of attention to the landlady, or he couldn't stay there. But now it's the official it's the official house of Balzac. There's something nice about that. Zola lived better, but it was in an apartment.
So these are two literary giants who mattered to you greatly, so much so that in your description you brought those two together, and you brought together the word reporter.
Yes.
Together with that, and I'm curious in how you went about reporting for this book, perhaps in that tradition.
Well, until I was 54 years old, I had never written intentionally a line of fiction. Everything was nonfiction. And I had decided to do a nonfiction novel about New York. And my inspiration was Vanity Fair, except that Vanity Fair is about really the upper orders of London. And I felt that in New York you had to take a look at everything. And so one day I heard about it. As a matter of fact, I was picking up my wife-to-be at Harper's Magazine, and she was the art director. And just to kill time while she was finishing up her work, I started exploring other people's offices. And I walked into David Halberstam's. He was off to lunch. And there on his desk was an invitation to a party given by Leonard Bernstein and his wife Felicia for the Black Panthers. And they lived at 895 Park Avenue, that's 79th and Park, in a tremendous duplex. And I said to myself, I've got to be there. I have got to be there. So I took a chance. I figured it's probably somebody at a committee who's writing down the names of the people who accept. So I called up and I said, my name is Tom Wolfe and I accept. And this young woman on the line says, how do you spell that? So I spelled it out. And sure enough, there was a security check at the duplex that the Bernsteins lived in. But my name was on the list and was no problem. And I think they assumed that anyone who was there was interested in the cause of the Black Panthers.
Were you?
Was I?
Yeah.
I was interested in them as a news item. And the party more than lived up to any expectations that I might have.
Well, it lived up the expectations so much that you wrote one of your most famous essays about them.
Yeah, well, the problem was it was such an incredible thing, you know, such as seeing the field marshal of the Black Panthers standing by one of Leonard Bernstein's twin pianos in the living room, saying, in effect, in the future there will be no apartments like this one for two people. That the old fire bell rang, and I had to write it right away for a newspaper. And there went the whole chapter, one of my key chapters of my nonfiction novel. So I said, oh, okay, I'll do something in fiction. And because I knew there were people around saying, he's ducking the big one. He's over 50, ducking the big one. So I wrote this novel called The Bonfire of the Vanities. And I found that it really ended up taking almost as much, well, it took up the same amount of reporting that somebody like Zola would put in. And that's been the story ever since, although he seemed to do it faster, Zola. He berated himself for turning out only 23 novels in 25 years. Today we consider that better than average. I don't know. I think it's because we have too many time and labor-saving devices and too many ways to kill time. I think most of IT, information technology, is a convenient way for wasting time. It gives you the illusion of great activity, and there's always a new form. Mark Zuckerberg became the first real capitalist, well, since Bill Gates, but particularly since people like John Jacob Astor and John D. Rockefeller, E.M. Harriman. These are all people who introduced a product and became rich doing it. Zuckerberg was just kind of throws you off the track because he wears gray T-shirts every day, sometimes with a gray sweater with what is known as a hoodie. And you feel like, well, he's just he has nothing to do with the great capitalist system, but he does. That's right. I can't do the arithmetic, but it's many, many, many billions of dollars. But anyway, to get back to what you said, or asking.
What was I asking?
I think you were asking something about this book, Back to Blood. Yes.
Yes, I was asking about Back to Blood. I figure we might as well talk about it a little bit. And I was asking about the relationship between your literary idols, Balzac and Zola, who went calepin en main with their notebook in their hand, making sure to get every detail right, and Tom Wolfe choosing no longer New York, no longer Atlanta, but Miami as his subject, and how you went about doing the research you needed to do, which you did also in Radical Chic, but now with this city, the city that has been written about a lot, and we might talk about that as well, you went about describing it in a certain way.
I really ended up operating pretty much like a journalist. I've always, if young writers ever, if it's not all that common, they'd come to me and say, how do I get started writing? My answer is, leave the building. Because we live in such a bizarre society, we'll look back at it and think so. There's so many things there you'd never imagine. First thing I discovered in Miami was that the so-called Little Havana is a place where you have a cup of coffee at the Versailles Cafe, you watch the old men playing checkers across the street. This is in Calle Ocho. And you've been to Little Havana. In fact, Little Havana, that one is full of, a lot of Nicaraguans live there now. But the real Little Havana is not very small, it's Hialeah, which borders Miami on Miami's northern border. And you really, if you ever go there, you really should take a look. There's a huge arched sign which says, "Welcome to Hialeah." obviously built for the racetrack that was the famous Hialeah, which still stands but is not used for very much. And you look through the arch, and now there is row after row after row of little houses, casitas they are called, and it's grown to be a city of maybe 225,000, of which I bet 190,000 are Cuban. It's quite remarkable, Hialeah. And then I remember going to a strip club. There are only 143 of them in that area.
You're very precise. Yes. 143 strip clubs.
Yeah.
In
what you'd call metropolitan Miami, which is a lot bigger than Miami proper.
So you went to one of them.
Yes, and I didn't realize that I would be the only person there with a necktie. I didn't have a white suit on. I had exactly what you see me in now, but a dark blue blazer. There weren't too many double-breasted blazers there either, come to think of it. And finally, a man came to me. He looked, I assumed he was a bouncer. He was a great, great big guy. And he points his finger up and he says, you're Tom Wolf. Wait till people hear about this. So I introduced him to the reporter from the Miami Herald who was sitting on my left. Figuring that would take a little bit of it. But you can be sure, though, actually, that no employee of a strip club is going to rat on you. That's all they need is just one whiff.
So this was part of the research for the novel.
Yeah. And a rather, you know, when you say that you're just doing it for research, something like that, no, you're saying it, nobody will believe you, but that was in fact what I, in fact, there's an entire chapter about strip club, come to think of it. So I did that, but there were so many things that were just, I'd never heard of that attracted me, such as the Columbus Day Regatta, which you
claim to be the most frivolous, exciting.
Well, it was pretty much a strip club, actually.
Yeah. What is it?
Well, the regatta is a sailboat race, and it goes from, I forget where it starts because nobody ever pays any attention to that, to a key called Elliott Key, which is probably maybe 40 miles south of Miami down. It's a key out in the ocean. And I imagine the Columbus Day Regatta started in the early days when the boat race was over. Everybody would get together probably on Elliott Key and have a few drinks and so forth. But the spectacle of all these people at Elliott Key having drinks
was different.
Became part of the lore of
So
Miami.
What did your reporting eye see there?
Well, we were talking about strip clubs. It was pretty much a strip club after 5 p.m. There were girls, lubricious girls wearing...
What kind of girls?
Lubricious.
Lubricious.
Wearing thong swimsuits. And whenever they climbed up a ladder, it looked like there were these two melons you were looking at going up. And as the day wore on, more and more of these girls would take off the top of their bikini. And as you went through the night, there were pornographic movies being shown on the sails of schooners. And boys and girls kind of having at it in every sort of way you can imagine. And it's not very sanitary because of the decks are full of debris. You can't imagine cigarette packages thrown away, beer cans. Every time the ship moves and the beer cans rolling, not the kind of place I'd want to lie down on. But you
went there to honor part of the book. It was.
Oh, I don't know if it honored it very much, but it was for the it was for the book. And I had never heard of the Columbus Day Regatta. And what particularly interested me is the clash of immigrants in Miami. Miami, to my knowledge anyway, is the only city in the world that is ruled politically by people from another country with another language and a completely different culture who took over and just at the voting machine in just slightly over a generation. Of course, I'm talking about the Cubans. I don't think there may have been cases in which invaders did that, but they were not.
And this is what interested you about Miami,
yes.
In part, is the extraordinary foreignness of this city in the United States, where a majority of people didn't come from here, but ruined it.
Today, more than half of Miami is made up of so-called recent immigrants. That means within the last 50 years. I mean, more than half of the city. And there were lots of stories about how people got in, you know, past customs and so forth. But I was interested in what they did after they arrived. And there's just an extraordinary mix in Miami. The police force breaks down. The police force is approximately 50% Cuban, and it's 70% Latin of all sorts of Latin Americans, 18% American black, and about 12% Anglo, as they're called in, that is to say white Americans. That's a huge change in a relatively short time. And when I first, people would ask me what I was thinking of doing next, I'd say, well, I'm thinking of doing a book on immigration. And the reaction was always the same thing. Oh, that's so interesting. Then they'd fall asleep standing up like a horse, you know.
So instead, you wrote Back to Blood, which is also about immigration.
Well, it is. That was the starting point.
So in your seven words, the last words are PhD.
I have one, but I was just flattering myself. Put that on the end.
You know, it's so funny you say that, because when I got my own, my parents were so unimpressed.
Fast company.
Yeah,
fast company.
Very fast. They were so unimpressed because my mother and father figured I already had PH in my name, and, you know, just one D wasn't a big deal. I remember my parents sending me a little cartoon from The New Yorker where you have a maître d' taking a reservation, and the maître d' says, is this for a medical doctor or a mere PhD? I tell this story in part so that we're amongst PhDs, but what interests me here is you did mention it, and I don't think you mention it only out of vanity. I think you also mention it because it matters to you, because the American Studies PhD you got from Yale University in a way informed your way of looking at the world. Max Weber and your interest, one might call it an obsession, with status and the anxiety status produces.
You're quite correct. American Studies was made up of four subjects concerning the United States: history, literature, economics, and sociology. And I went to a liberal arts college, Washington and Lee in Virginia, and we tended to look down on things like sociology as arriviste, you know, mostly people from abroad who decided to get into this muck. But as soon as I started reading in that area and found the works of Max Weber, I said, it was like my eyes opening. This is
why.
The way. I had never thought of all the ways in which we think of status in the most unlikely places. For the example, well, I won't go into it in great detail, but I mean, just going to the bathroom, you'd be amazed at the choices that you make because of the people around you and how you're expected to. Oh, that's just to be a messy example, but I mean, that's an example of something you do in solitude, and which you still think of. You still think of your status. If people only knew, or only thought about, I mean, they know why they choose the mates they choose, and what enormous parts of the male or female population are excluded, they just simply are impossible in terms of status. It would surprise you. I look upon it as a constant motive. The only time that we are not conscious of it, I'm conscious of it right now, man, is when we face death, particularly sudden violent death. Then I think you pretty much drop looking the right way.
You mean you don't anymore think where you come from?
No, and you don't think about what restaurants will give you a good seat and all those things. You're just up against it, but that's a pretty extreme way to get away from it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the phrases that comes up again and again and again in your work is where things are happening.
Yes.
I'd like you to unpack this notion. I think it's very germane to what you just said.
Well, that's why New York survives. That's why New York City survives. We don't produce anything anymore. All the garment industry first went to the South, and then they found there was cheaper labor in Bangladesh and China. There went much of the production. If you consider the financial market to be productive, you can make that argument. I don't think it's productive. It's just a market where things change. But we live on the fact that we are where things are happening. And people from all over the world want to come to New York for that.
But they also want to go, and I think Back to Blood expresses this as well as New York might, they also want to go to Miami because that's where things are happening. That's where regattas are showing porn films. A lot is, as you said, from 5 p.m. onwards. Yeah. And, you know, you were rather discreet as compared to the book, explaining what happens at that Columbus parade. This is what attracts you.
Well, I didn't know how bizarre Miami was going to be. Most books novels that I've read about Miami seem to center upon South Beach, which is, in fact, pretty much an Anglo or American white vacation spot within Miami. I have quite a bit about Haitians, and I knew next to nothing about the life of Haitian. It's a big part of Miami. Russians. I never dreamed that it would be Russians pouring into Miami. Mostly they live up towards Sunny Isles, which is like where Miami Beach meets the mainland, or Hallandale, another town. And which reminds me, there is so little mixing of people. There is no one society with a capital S. There's a Cuban society with some very wealthy people, but there's also completely separate Jewish society, completely separate Anglo society, all this beginning to disappear. Miami is a melting pot where you throw in all these ingots and you come back 2 days later and they haven't changed. They won't melt. They hang on to the... And that's hence...
Why should they, though?
Well, because that's the American way.
I mean, you say in Back to Blood, you say in Miami, everybody hates everybody.
Well, that's an intentional overstatement, but it's what results when people do not mix the way they do in most of the rest of the country. Although the title "Back to Blood" doesn't refer to wet blood, but to bloodlines.
And you used it in Bonfire of the Vanities as well.
I don't even. I did, but I didn't remember doing it. But I think that is the.
I mean, we can read it.
But that's the zeitgeist of our times. I really believe it's particularly when religion declines in influence. People can always go back to their bloodlines. Every time, the Puerto Rican Day Parade, the cry. Right here in New York, is La Raza, meaning the race. Well, nobody thinks of it that way when they hear it, but I think this is an era in which practically every group would like to go around saying, La Raza, La Raza! And I hope they don't, but it is something you can always fall back on.
We discussed briefly when we spoke that you might honor us with a reading. And I'd like you to read this passage, which I will show you. I don't know if you prefer reading standing.
I think standing.
Yes. Well, if you prefer standing, we will give you a podium where you can stand.
I saw a podium disappear earlier.
No, the podium will reappear.
Will reappear. Okay.
It's reappearing right there.
Hey.
And this is a passage we decided you would read.
Ah, yes.
Up to there. I made it a little bit shorter. Maybe you can set up the reading for us and tell us in what context it appears.
Well, this is, forgive my roaming polka dot necktie. This is, introduces one of the main characters in the book, the chief of police, but I think it's pretty self-evident. If I
all right.
This was the sort of thing the chief never talked about to anybody. Anybody. He wasn't a fool, after all. People would sooner talk about their sex lives, like sometimes cops, you couldn't shut them up. Or their money, or their messy marriages, or their sins in the eye of God, about anything other than their status in this world, their place in the social order, their prestige, or their mortifying lack of it, the respect they get, the respect they don't get, their jealousy and resentment of those who wallow in respect everywhere they set foot. All this went through the chief's mind in a single blip, as his driver, Sergeant Sanchez, pulled up in front of City Hall in the chief's official Escalade. The Miami City Hall was a curiously small white building that stood alone on a half-acre triangle of land that was, in fact, landfill sticking out into Biscayne Bay. The Escalade, on the other hand, was a huge brute, all black, with darkened windows, without a single marking to indicate it was a police vehicle. Only a low black bar across the roof containing a lineup of spotlights and flasher lights and flasher lenses and a light on the dashboard no bigger than a quarter emitting some sort of ominous x-ray like radiation. As soon as they stopped, the chief fairly sprang from the passenger seat in front. Right next to Sergeant Sanchez, the driver. The last thing he wanted people to think was that he was an old coot who had to be chauffeured around. Like many men in their mid-40s, he wanted to look young. athletic, virile. And so he sprang, imagining himself a lion or a tiger or a panther, a vision of lithe strength in any case. What a sight it was, or so he was convinced. He couldn't very well ask anybody, could he? He wore a darkest blue military-style shirt, tie, and pants, black shoes, and a dark wraparound sunglasses. No jacket. This was Miami. 10 o'clock on a September morning, and the cosmic heat lamp was high overhead, and it was already 88 degrees out here. On each side of his neck, which he figured looked about as thick as a tree trunk, a row of 4 gold stars ran along each side of his navy blue collar, a galaxy of 8 stars in all, and atop that starry tree trunk was his dark face. There were 6 feet 4 inches and 230 pounds of him, and with big wide shoulders, and he was unmistakably African American, and he was the chief of police. Oh yeah, how they stared! All these people going in and out of City Hall, and he loved it. The Escalade was in the traffic circle right in front of the entrance. The chief stepped onto the curb. He stopped for a moment. He lifted his arms out to the side with bent elbows, thrust his shoulders back as far as they would go, and took a deep breath. He looked like... He looked like he was stretching after being cooped up in the car. In fact, he was forcing his chest to bulge out full-blown. He bet that made him look twice as mighty, but of course he couldn't very well ask anybody, could he? He was still in mid-stretch, mid-preen, when, "Hey, Chief!" He was a young man, but he had City Hall lifer written all over him. Light skin, probably Cuban, emerging from the entrance and beaming a smile of homage at him and paying his respects with a wave that began at his forehead and turned into half a salute. Had he ever laid eyes on this kid before? Did he work in the Bureau of, what the hell was it? Anyway, he was paying homage. The chief blessed him with a lordly smile and said, "Hi, big guy." He had barely rolled his shoulders forward into a normal position when a middle-aged couple passed him on their way into City Hall. They looked Cuban, too. The man swung his head around and sang out, "How's it going, chief?" Homage. The chief blessed him with a lordly smile and favored him with a, "Hi, big guy." In rapid succession, another, "Hey, chief, how you doing?" And then, "Hi, Cy," short for Cyrus, his first name. "And keep him flying, Cy," and he hadn't even reached the door yet. The citizen seems to enjoy paying homage with salutations that rhymed with Cy. His last name, Booker, was too much for their poetic powers, which was just as well the way he looked at. Otherwise, everybody would call him, with mockery or racial or personal insult, Mooka, Spooka, Lookra, Hooker. It was all just as well. So the chief said, "Hi, big guy. Hi, big guy. Hi, big guy. Hi, big guy." Well, that was a lungful of status, wasn't it?
Tell me why you chose that passage. You had no doubt when I asked you, "Would you like to read a passage on stage?" And you said, "Absolutely." You immediately identified that passage. Why?
Well, for that very reason. And in fact, if I'd gone on pages, you'd see that the chief, Cyrus Booker, was quite aware that he was not chosen in the ordinary political trail of things. In fact, he was the 4th black police chief of Miami, all chosen since 1980 when there was the famous Liberty City riots, which are really quite brutal riots. And periodically, Miami installs a black police chief so that they can say, "Hey, what do you want from me? We gave you a black chief." And he knows that's true, but at the same time, he says, that means that Dio, that's the mayor's name, is Dionysius Cruz, you can understand he shortened it to Dio. That means that Dio liked me better than the other deputy chiefs. So it's all status. Incidentally, I should tell you, for years, the term I used was status, because that was the term that was used by the faculty in graduate school. I figured that was status was a social thing, and status was how the steam boiler was doing. I had these two terms, and one was status, social, the other was status, the condition of things. Only to find out that the reason the faculty used the pronunciation status was that was the way it's done in England. And, you know, we are so, to this day, intellectual subjects of England and France, particularly. And they all feel, and I feel too, you know, they have better accents.
I can't comment on that.
Yours sounds more Austrian to me.
Well, when people ask me, I say it's just affected. I don't know. it's confused. It's a mixture of many things.
I think it's
But you're right. My parents are Viennese, so you have a good ear.
Well, I do have a good ear. I find it terrific, honestly.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll keep it. I'm curious about the cast of characters you chose. And I see it once again, since you were talking about the impact of France. I see Balzac and Zola behind all of it. I see, you know, in the introduction to La Comédie Humaine, to the human comedy, Balzac talks about his indebtedness to Buffon, to the great zoologists, and to the desire in some way to create a zoology of human nature. And you have a second generation Cuban cop, Nestor. You have a WASP newspaper reporter, John Smith, with whom you may or may not identify somewhat. A doctor who treats billionaire sex addicts and who may treat them in many interesting ways. A Russian oligarch and a Haitian literature professor. Why this cast? I mean, it's a very interesting cast of character.
I'm convinced that Zola particularly must have done the same thing, but I don't know. I get interested in a
type.
Subject first, or a locale where things are happening.
Happening.
And wait for the characters to walk in. I think it's the only sound way. For example, when I first did The Bonfire of the Vanities, serially, for Rolling Stone, the only magazine wild enough to print a serial novel of 27 issues, and God bless Jan Winter for doing that. Anyway, when I wrote that, to save time and effort, I had the main character be a writer. Only he was living on Park Avenue at 75th Street. And look around as I might, I think Louis Auchincloss lived on Park somewhere, but that was about it. This guy was a lot younger than Louis was at that time. And I really wasted a great opportunity, because then I heard about, in conversation, about the investment bankers who were riding high. This was 1984 when I started writing that. And they were the people in the book eventually called the Masters of the Universe. And I found that so new and exciting that I went into that world. I spent time down at Solomon Brothers and sat at the left hand of the head of the government bond desk. Bonds were everything at that time. We were talking about the 80s. Stocks were a minor concern. And little by little, and then I had a, I knew a policeman who took me around the Bronx. He was off duty in his own car. I won't get off on any more tangents, but just let me mention this one thing. The off-duty policeman and myself ran into a traffic jam in the Bronx, and suddenly these squeegee people emerged. And you could hear the locks, windows go up on the other cars. Clunk, 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 clunk. But this fellow, the policeman, pushed his down. So the window came down. And this guy comes over and he's smearing soap all over the windshield. And then he comes back around as if, you know, he's waiting for his payment. And this cop, of course, I couldn't see his face. I was in the right-hand seat. He said, thank you very much. You did an excellent job. I didn't ask you to do it, but you did it. So I have to give you my thanks. And to my amazement, the guy kind of backed off and went on to the next car. So I said, my God, it's that simple. So I was riding east on 62nd Street near where I lived onto the drive. And suddenly here they come, the squeegees. And so everybody else is putting their windows up, clunk, 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 clunk. I put mine down. And the guy smears my window and whatever they do. And he comes by the front of the car. I looked at him and I said, thank you very much. You did a terrific job. I didn't ask you to do it, but you did it. And I can only say thank you. And the response, I'm not sure what was not on my face, but pretty soon there was a scraper up against my cheek. It wasn't violent. The guy wasn't, but it wasn't what I expected. Now, in this new book, I do identify something called the cop look.
Right.
And there is a cop look, because on the streets, a policeman on the beat is the most powerful person in the world. Not after an arrest or not in many, but out there on the street, he's the tops. And he knows how to give the look that goes with it.
How does this work with the notion of creating these 7 or 8 characters and creating a taxonomy, one might say? I see you responding to that word. But you are creating a zoological human taxonomy of this city of immigrants. And you're choosing characters that could verge on being stereotypical of the city of Miami.
Well, they could be stereotypical if it weren't for the fact that nobody had written about them before, which I think somewhat undercuts the notion of a stereotype. I don't think most people have any, I certainly didn't when I went into it, have any idea of what, let's say, Cuban family life is like in Miami. An Argentine journalist told me, never try to make an appointment with a Cuban on the weekend. That's because it's given over to the family. I'm sure that the divorce rate among Cubans is far, far lower than among any other people that I'm aware of. In fact, in Hialeah, if you've had the same neighbors for quite a while, you tend to call them uncle and aunt in everyday conversation. Very, very family-minded. Very few youngsters, some do, but very few youngsters can get out of the house without marrying.
A couple of themes that seem so important to me that I would be remiss not mentioning them tonight is your persistent interest in the art world, and your persistent interest in the art world in Miami is combined with your discovery of the relationship between the art world in Miami and pornography. And you have some passages, one of them about defucked, which is quite extraordinary. Later on, Magdalena asked around and was told that that the Linger, a large gallery, wanted to show its private collection of photorealistic pornographic paintings, whatever photorealistic meant, and sculptures of homosexual orgies. Why was there so much pornography in this so-called cutting-edge art? Magdalena wondered, for what earthly reason?
Oh, I think it's because as long as it's under the umbrella of art.
As long as what?
As long as it's under the umbrella of art. And I do know of a gallery in Miami is like that. It's a secret room devoted to such images. Then it has a halo, an atmosphere of something higher.
Why do you think, because it is interesting how protective we are of this category that we call art. And it's happening now and would be deflated by you if you were going to go and take a trip to Miami Art Basel. I think they might, after having read this book, be somewhat worried by your presence.
I found that I've written about the art world a number of times, and the sum total of my influence has been absolutely nothing.
But it's made us laugh.
Yeah. Well, there's a very simple history of this. It starts in France, and we always, in the arts, we love to do what the French do. It was in the 1880s, and some newspaper decided to do a survey of the literary world. There was a Catul Mendes, who was a minor poet and a wealthy young man, who said that, he said, you know, today we don't write for multitudes the way Zola and Maupassant do. We write for an aristocratic minority of intellectuals. And the great writers today are not Zola and Maupassant. The great writers are Baudelaire and Rimbaud and Mallarmé. And it was very important that that the average person not be able to understand those writers. And it's true. I mean, they may seem simple compared to some of common sense, but they are very hard to read and understand.
And the bridge between that and the art world is what?
Well, in that kind of work became Joyce's, became the kind of literature that proved you were intellectually above the mob, which today goes under the name middle class, of course. And so the same thing began to take hold in art. It's hard to believe how popular and what a great reputation that Bouguereau, for example, had at the end of the 19th century. You get in, this actually, it's also beautiful. I'm going to do this very rapidly. First, there's Cubism. Now, if I couldn't draw better than Picasso, I'd start a new movement. And I'd call it Cubism. So that was the first step. Then the abstract expressionists said, let's get rid of reality altogether. I mean, a lot of Picasso is more or less realistic. And people like Malevich said that we don't paint God's images. He gives them to everybody. We paint something entirely original, entirely abstract. And then the pop artists. Warhol is a great figure. He did no hands art. He'd get a photograph, which he didn't take, and or a photograph from a ping pong booth in an amusement hall, and have his elves in this place called the factory, put paint on these images, and that gave permission to not to have to use your hands at all in, as they say, making art. Yeah, what a making art. and today, you know, I just to show you how little impact I've had writing about it. Today, there are two new fields developed from Warhol. The first is no hands art. Richard Serra and these great walls of Corten steel, which of course he has never touched. He has unionized elves to put them in front of buildings. A 45-foot high rabbit made of dirt with various vegetation growing on it. He's done several of those. Of course he didn't touch those. And even the ones in which he had a photographer take pictures of himself and this well-known Italian prostitute, La Cucinello or something like that, she'd been in a political scandal, sort of having at each other in every way you could possibly imagine, photographed. And then the photographs, I'm sure he didn't mail them, the photographs were sent to Switzerland, where more elves made them out of glass in three dimensions. And there's sums of money that these figures.
Are you saying that the emperor has no clothes?
No, I'm just saying it's since you have, in almost every case, one-off objects, it makes people feel they're getting something very special.
Because you speak in your book of a school that you call the de-skilled school of art, and you mention a line by Tom Stoppard, and I don't quite know if you identify with that line or feel critical towards it. You say, Tom Stoppard said, imagination without skill gives us modern art.
Yes. And it's so true. I mean, look at it. Was it today's paper where there's this great to-do over a painting by de Kooning, I believe it is. It's called something like The Sinkhole. De Kooning was another person who could not draw. I'm sorry, he couldn't. But he could mess around quite artfully.
Well, you describe in the book, in closing, you describe extraordinary scenes with billionaires, with art billionaires who put on every wall of any institution they possibly can their name, and they're extremely funny passages about that. In some way, you're describing an art scene that hasn't really changed since you.
No, it hasn't. It's just gotten, I think, more bizarre. The term de-skilled is one that was originated in the Yale art department, if I'm not mistaken. Skill is so artificial.
Why bother?
It fools the eye. It makes you see things that are really not there. Whereas if you make a painting, for example, and make it obvious that it's two dimensions and not three. I mean, third dimension is fatal. That's all trickery. But two dimensions is perfectly okay. And these things take on a value because most of the population, of the mob, does not understand what you're doing, which delights the art world. By art world, I'm talking about a village of about 3,000 people in the world who make all the decisions as to what is good and what is bad. And today, that art world, what kind you see at Miami Art Basel, just coming up, folks, if you like.
Next week?
Yes.
You're not going, though?
No, I'm not going.
let's leave it at that okay. For the moment. You simply are not going.
That's true. No, I was there once.
You certainly were there.
I went to every phase.
I imagine what the folks back there think.
I think it made no impression. It's like I did I Am Charlotte Simmons. I did quite a bit about my heroine, Charlotte Simmons, being from a town called Spotter, North Carolina. It's a little town up in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And so I ran into a teacher who had moved on from Spotter somewhere else in her life. And I said, you know, it's the funniest thing. I got no reaction at all from Spotter, and I had quite a bit about it. She said, what on earth makes you think they read it? And that's a good thing for a writer to put in the back of his mind. What on earth makes you think they read it?
In closing, two items. One has to do with the prurience of journalists. Do you recognize yourself in the character of John Smith?
In many ways, I do.
You do. Yeah. I mean, because there's a line by Janet Malcolm in The Journalist and the Murderer, which strikes me. Anything really to get the scoop. She says, every journalist who is not too stupid or too full of himself to notice what is going on knows that what he does is morally indefensible.
There's a lot of truth in it. You're really part of the job, on particularly newspapers, is to catch people at doing this and doing that. It's not true on
catch a fool.
Catch a fool, or yeah,
or both,
or blackguard. It's not true on television because there is no reporting on television. None. Except for scheduled events. Television is great at scheduled events. You know, the game starts at 3, and it's going to be covered better than in the newspaper. I wonder what's going to happen when print goes completely online. There will be no more beats, as we used to call them on newspapers, where you're assigned to cover, let's say, anything from the...
Will there not be beats, or will they just be quicker beats?
No, I think that nobody will linger, I don't think, on any particular subject for long. It'd be a fulfillment of Marshall McLuhan's prediction, which I didn't understand at the time. This is back in 1968. He said, television has changed the sensory balance, whatever that is, of a whole generation. As a result, they're turning tribal. And he said, tribal people, if presented with a piece of paper with writing on it, assume it's a trick, that they will only believe what somebody tells them right next to them. In other words, they will only believe rumors. And the blogosphere has become pretty much a rumor mill, fact checking, and it's a great time for people to get away with murder. At least newspaper reporters only got away with half the job, because damn it, there were people checking facts.
So why do you identify with John with that character?
There are many reasons. I have him go into areas that psychologically, he's afraid of going into. They worry him. But he has this job. He has to do it, so he does it. And I think that's...
At any cost.
At any cost. I think it's... there's something marvelous about it. I
mean, but something also reprehensible about it.
Well, yes and no. I can remember being caught in a crossfire between a psychotic individual and the police. I got caught because of my competition on the Washington Star was in between it. I thought, well, God, I'd better get in between the two batteries of guns, too. Not because I like doing things like that.
The next book you're writing now is about Darwin. In
yes.
some way, not surprising choice.
Well, this book is, I'm borrowing the title from Zola, The Human Beast. And it's the story of the theory of evolution, which is a very funny story. And, you know, you start with Darwin and this unknown man named Alfred Russel Wallace, and then you get into the sociology of truth. You see why the theory was accepted. He had people like Thomas Huxley, who were a kind of wonderful, powerful scourge who would wipe out biology departments that didn't teach the Darwinist message. And then the Darwinist message had this damn genetic stuff to battle. That had been done in Germany by not even a priest, he was a monk. And then they managed to, there's a rapprochement between genetics and evolution. And that, they felt they really had it by then. And to move quickly, you get up to the present in which any professor at a university who shows a dogged disbelief in Darwin is shoved out one way or another, even if he has tenure. I mean, this is biblical stuff. And it just gets funny. There's the people who believe that, Edward O. Wilson, I think he's been at this audience before. Edward O. Wilson believes that every human brain is born as a piece of film waiting to be slipped into developer fluid. And he says, it may be developed very well. It may be developed poorly, but all you're going to get is what's on that film to begin with. So you know your life is set. So I went to a conference on neuroscience and the law. The idea was if all of these things are predetermined, you have no choice, and they happen, and they are heinous by our standards. Murder, so forth. How do we deal with this fact that they have no choice and be fair under the law? Oh, a great wrangle over this. So on the discussion period, I raised my hand and I said, well, if we have no free choice, why on earth should we believe what you just said? Having no standing in the field, I made no impression. At all, but it's quite true. If it's really true, then the lawyer, professor, whatever, on the stage has no choice but to say that there's no choice. This is known as in sociology as reflexism. It started at a conference where there was a great theory in sociology that. There are no theories that are not socially determined. And so a sociologist with standing raised his hand in the back of the hall and said, well, if all theories are determined socially, what about the theory that there is no that all theories are determined socially. And that was the end of that theory in sociology.
I love these kinds of stories. I remember when a logic professor came to Columbia and was trying to disprove that two negatives make a positive, and Stanley Morgenbesser said, "Yeah, yeah." I mean, there's always these great lines. I think, Tom, what we'll do, if with your permission, is take some very good questions for the next 10 minutes.
All right.
But first, we would like to thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I will ask you to come up to the mic and ask your questions. As I said, unlike my own questions, they can be asked in about 50 seconds. After which time, Tom Wolfe will sign some books. Please come on up and speak clearly.
Thank you. If I may, I have two very quick questions. I'd like to know how long you were in Miami before you sat down and started to do the book. And secondly, I'd like to know, in the list of writers that you take issue with and the writers you do not take issue with, where does John Steinbeck fit?
Oh, I'm a great Steinbeck fan, and I took exception to the response among other writers when he died. It was just amazing. They hated the fact that he had won the Nobel Prize. And he himself hated the fact that it was for Travels with Charlie and not The Grapes of Wrath. I'm a great fan of his. The two writers I'm especially fond of currently are Michael Lewis and Mark Bowden, both nonfiction writers. The first chapter of Liar's Poker by Michael Lewis, and it's all true, had enormous repercussions on our economy. it's quite amazing. It makes a hero out of a man who goes on to form a company called Long Term Capital. And people couldn't throw enough money through the door of Long Term Capital after reading the way he had out-dueled John Goodfriend at Solomon Brothers. Finally, the U.S. government had to step in. They had $1 trillion worth of bets out on the markets. And the whole world economic system could have crashed. Michael Lewis started.
But the question was also how long you spent in...
Oh, I'm sorry,
No, please.
I think it was exactly 12 trips to Miami over 2 years, and I don't remember staying any longer than 2 weeks at one time. But
out of choice, out of choice.
Oh yes, I mean there's always things that I needed to learn more about.
Thank you.
Given the fact that, or the notion that you said that Miami is kind of an melting pot, did you find any difficulties kind of melting in order to perform your journalistic duties? Were there any characters that wouldn't really budge, per se?
Well, did you say snobbery? I don't remember. No?
No, the melting pot. Did you have any trouble getting into the melting pot in order to do your journalism?
I mean, did I get into it?
Yeah.
To a certain extent, I spent, of course, a lot of time with Cubans, but also Russians and Haitians. And I think it's really very instructive to find out, for example, that American blacks and black Haitians do not get along at all. And the reasons why are quite why the Cubans are well, that's not true of every African American, but they tend to be resented by African Americans as if they dropped out of the sky and suddenly running the entire city. All of those things not only fascinate me, but I think they're absolutely necessary to understand the characters. The idea that we have private cells, I think, is grossly overrated. Because the moment we intersect with the society around us, it's going to change one's life. And if a big part of the society around you is a some sort of powerful government, that really makes it hard to escape from society. Even the Unabomber, living in a cave, thought about nothing but the society that he was hiding from.
Thank you.
Shall we end on that note?
The Unabomber?
I know. I just am wondering if we should end on that note. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.